Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to the Science of Success. Introducing your host, Matt Bodner.
Welcome to the Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet, with more than 1 million downloads and listeners in over 100 countries. In this episode, we discuss how money messes with your head. We look into the obvious traps we fall into when we think about money, examine how cultural influences shape our financial choices, and explore the key biases that underpin the most common and dangerous financial mistakes that you are most likely to make in your life with our guest, Jeff Kreisler. I'm going to give you 3 reasons why you should join our email list today by going to successpodcast.com and signing up right on the homepage. There's some amazing stuff that's only available to our email subscribers, so be sure to sign up and join the email list. Number one, you're going to get an awesome free guide that we created based on listener demand. Our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide when you sign up and join the email list today. Next, you're going to get a curated weekly email from us every single week called Mindset Monday. Listeners have been loving this email. It's short, simple, filled with actionable videos, articles, and things that we found enjoyable within the last week. Lastly, you're going to get an exclusive chance to shape the show. You can vote on guests, change our intro music, even submit your own questions to our guests, and much more when you join the email list. You can do that by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage, or if you're on the go, if you're driving around and you're out and about, just text the word SMARTER, that's S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. That's SMARTER to 44222. In our previous episode, we discussed how to build a rock star brain. We went into the neurochemical compositions that create moods from happiness to depression, and we looked at how you can change the building blocks of those neurochemicals by changing your diet and your daily habits. In a world where people are more stressed than ever, sleeping less, and trying to do more, we looked at the causes of brain drain and what we can do to have physically happier brains with Dr. Michael Dow. If you want to think with crystal clarity, listen to that episode. Today, we have another exciting guest on the show, Jeff Kreisler. Jeff is a best-selling author and winner of the Bill Hicks Spirit Award for thought-provoking comedy. He is most recently the co-author of a new book, Dollars and Cents, How We Misthink Money and How to Spend Smarter with Dan Ariely, who is a previous guest on the show. Jeff is a regular contributor to CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and much more. Jeff, welcome to the Science of Success.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited to have you on here today. So to get started, I'd love to talk a little bit about a previous book that you wrote, and there's a TED Talk around this as well, which is called Get Rich Cheating. Tell me a little bit about kind of what inspired you to give that talk and you know, what sort of underpins that.
Sure. So I can give you the short-ish version, which is that I was spent many years doing political comedy. And one of the things that drove me into that was sort of pointing out the hypocrisies that's obvious in politics. Through that, I ended up getting an opportunity to work for Jim Cramer's TheStreet.com, writing a humor column about finance. And then through that, I got an opportunity to pitch a book idea to a publisher. And I pitched this idea of Get Rich Cheating. And it was basically looking at these get rich quick books. Typically, it's how to flip real estate is almost all of what their suggestions are. And looking at that combined with this study of hypocrisy, I guess you could say, I had both in the world of finance and politics and sports and you know, people sort of shelling out their prepackaged advice, all of which sort of had the same theme. And it felt like it was a great way to use a vehicle of satire to sort of make a commentary about, you know, our obsession with money and really what our system of gaining money sort of was really about, whether it was the restrictions in this real mobility that we talked about, or just the fact that we became so obsessed with getting money and getting rich that we often could justify cutting corners and being unethical. And the book became like a combination of really digging into the research of like the Enrons and Bernie Madoffs and the steroid scandal, and even the lesser known things. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners remember WorldCom, but there were plenty of smaller scandals. Well, people got rich but didn't get in trouble, or the trouble they got in was a small fine. And so sort of one of the overarching themes of the book, which is what then fed this lecture and talk and show, was kind of everyone's doing it, no one's getting caught, why not, right? It was a cost-benefit analysis. There's no cost. One guy get caught, Bernie Madoff, no one else got in trouble, and the benefits are gigantic. And this sort of message kind of resonated in a weird way. Like I spoke at business school sometimes doing a satirical thing, and I wouldn't say it was a joke. It was obviously funny, but just interesting ideas. And people would say, oh, yeah, that makes sense, because it eliminated the idea of ethics. And obviously, ethics and morality are important for society function. But if you're strictly an economic actor, it's just cost benefit. You don't latch onto it. I kind of went a little far afield from where the question being like, how was it inspired? And it was sort of inspired as a unique vehicle to sort of expose some of the hypocrisies and challenges in our system. And it was a lot of fun to do. I did it, you know, theaters and business schools and comedy clubs and all over the place.
Well, we're definitely going to include your TED Talk in the show notes so the listeners can kind of get a taste of that. But I just found it really fascinating because, you know, the show, The Science of Success, is all about evidence-based growth. And we really try to focus on the science, the data, the evidence. And I found your speech to be a really great kind of amalgamation of a lot of the tropes within the self-help industry that are, you know, kind of totally the opposite of evidence-based. You know, people hawking their own personal systems and these kind of things. And I just thought it was a great kind of expose in many ways of a lot of those methods of behavior, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. One thing I did when I created the show and when I took it off the book page was I sort of looked at like the Tony Robbins type. And I actually think Tony Robbins has some value to add, but he is a great avatar for, you know, these sort of self-help people. I remember Tom Cruise's character in that movie, in Magnolia, for those that might know that relatively obscure reference. And it was just about, like, as you said, it wasn't evidence-based that I was presenting, even though I was using facts about people that did it. It was just these things that resonated with people emotionally. Like, I think I had a whole setup where it was like, you've got to visualize your dreams. And I would talk about getting rich and being so rich you could afford Fabergé egg omelets and you could buy giraffes. And, you know, you visualize your dream, then you confront the obstacles to your dreams. And it's stuff like ethics and it's stuff like society and your board of directors, and then you bust through those obstacles to achieve your dreams, and it's stuff about how you cheat on your 10b5 forms or whatever it is, or how do you take steroids, or who do you use to back you up, and all the different ways that people cheated. But it was all in this very like emotion triggering format of visualizing dreams and being a real man and like, rah, let's go get it. That is what a lot of like self-help tends to be, is it goes for that emotional response, not the factual one, not the intellectual one. And that is sort of what we fall into. And in a way, you know, we'll get into this later, that's sort of what my latest book about money is about how when we make financial decisions based upon emotion, and often unconsciously based upon emotion, we're led away from the best scientific, rational, intellectual choice. And certainly when it comes to cheating and it comes to like trying to get super rich at any cost, the emotion is in there. You know, we get, our eyes get big and we get excited for all the things we can do and stuff we can buy with money.
So let's dig into that a little bit. Tell me about your book, Dollars and Cents, and how, let's start really simply. How do you define money? What is money?
Sure. Money is essentially supposed to represent the value of other things. I mean, money is a great development. And, you know, despite a lot of my work criticizing sort of what money has done to us, it has allowed society to become what it is. If not, we'd be constantly bartering, constantly struggling just to survive. And money allows us to specialize, to pursue arts and sciences, to save. You know, money is divisible. Money is storable. It's fungible and exchangeable. It's a wonderful thing because money represents other stuff. Money really represents opportunity costs. And many of your listeners may have heard the concept opportunity cost or know what it is. An opportunity cost is basically like, what are the other things you could do with money besides what it is you're about to spend on? So like if you're going to buy a coffee, and buying coffee is like the common financial example, so I'll just stick with that for now. If you're going to spend $5 on a latte, what else could you do with the money? Now, there's tons of stuff. You could save it. You could buy 5 lottery tickets. You could buy, you know, whatever, 500 penny candies. There's a world of opportunities both now and in the future. And that is what's great about money. But it's also what is the challenge about money, because that's a lot to think about. It's a lot to like conceive of all the possible things you can do with money. It's impossible for humans to do that. But on a, you know, strictly sort of scientific economic basis, that's what we should do, is we should think about that opportunity cost. What ends up happening is that because it is so difficult, because it's so difficult to really evaluate all the options for, you know, this $5, we end up taking shortcuts. And that's okay, but oftentimes taking those shortcuts, it goes to such extreme lengths that we lose sight of even any other options. My co-author, Dan Ariely, who some of your listeners may know from his book Predictably Irrational and other books, he did an experiment where he and some colleagues went to a Toyota dealership, and they asked people at the Toyota dealership, hey, you're about to spend, let's say, $25,000 on a car. What else could you do with that $25,000? And they couldn't think of anything. They just couldn't like even get out of the idea of spending it on the car. And when pressed further, they said, well, if I don't buy a Toyota, I could buy a Honda. So even there, they thought of an alternative, but it was still within the same category. It was still about buying a car, when really $25,000 is 5 vacations for 5 years. It's, you know, it's a quarter of a year less work in your life. It can be so many different things. So money is about opportunity costs, which is great, but it is also tremendously challenging. And it's why we have such difficulty thinking about money and evaluating what we should do, and why, because of that difficulty, we end up taking shortcuts that are often not the best decisions.
I feel like it's really challenging. And I mean, as someone who, you know, comes out of the financial world, I used to work on Wall Street, and I'm still an investor by trade. The kind of infinite possibilities of the opportunity costs of money, how do we start to kind of wrap our heads around that?
Well, one thing you can do, and one thing that drove us to write this book, is to start being cognizant of the biases that we have, or the value cues, the shortcuts essentially that I'm talking about, that we take when we can't evaluate a financial choice. And once you're aware of those, then, you know, we don't want you to face every decision and then spin in your head, but you can start setting up systems to help yourself perform better. For instance, we know that we don't save enough money. We know that we burn through our discretionary spending at a rate that we probably shouldn't. If you're aware of that, then you can set up a system. One idea that we put forward is that's been proven to work, is if you have a separate account, like a checking account, and then you have a savings account, and you get some money put in your savings account, some in your checking account. Because most of us think about how much money we have to spend based upon what's on our checking account, you know, what's on that balance when we take out money from the ATM. We can sort of trick ourselves into thinking we have less money But even if we stop to think about, we know, oh, we have an extra 50% of our paycheck went over to this other account. But what we see is how we decide what to spend. And so we can sort of trick ourselves to end up spending less. That's one sort of simple suggestion. So ultimately, the biases and value cues and shortcuts that we talk about in the book and that others talk about elsewhere, being aware of those is the first and the biggest step towards then developing a personal system or a system within your family or a system within, you know, your company or even your community to make better financial decisions. And it feels a little woo-woo, but it is very true. Like, just awareness is a huge difference maker. If you just think about how in this country, we don't really talk about money that much. I mean, it's ironic. In a way, we quote unquote talk about it because we obsess about it. We're like, what does, you know, our sports heroes make for money? Like, who's making this much? And like, we're always thinking about money, but we never think about how we think about it. And in particular, we never really talk about savings, right? Spending is very obvious. What people are spending, it's easy to compete. Your neighbor has a new addition on their house or a new car or paints their house, or your friend gets a new flat screen TV. Like, it's easy to compete on consumption, but you never are aware of what people are saving. And really, that's one of the most important things you can do with money is to save it or to invest it for college kids, for your kids to go to college, for you to retire. But we never talk about that. Like, I doubt very highly that any of your listeners or many of your listeners know what their friends are saving. There actually was a study that men are more willing to admit whether or not they use Viagra than how much they've saved in their 401k. Right? I mean, like, you think like the thing about like just how dysfunctional and tiny your savings is would be more impactful and more personal and private than Viagra use, but it's not. And it's something that I hope that as a culture, we can start to break through that wall and be a little more comfortable talking about money. It's understandable that we aren't. I come from a family that never really talked about those things either, at least not about like savings, but just that awareness that it's an issue, I think will help us grow and develop better habits. And, you know, if we can compete on the good aspects of money as well as the bad ones, I think we'd be better off.
I think that's a really good point. And the whole idea of kind of how money in many ways is a central focus of our society with things, you talk about the Kardashians and, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous and all of these things. But at the same time, it's only one kind of facet of money. And really the most important facets, things like saving, investing, et cetera, really aren't on the forefront. And I think in many ways, you know, one of the things that I look at is that it feels like our educational system in many ways has kind of failed to educate us about, you know, in most cases, even sort of basic financial literacy.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, we could talk for several more hours or days about what our education system has failed us on. But that's certainly true that we don't have a system that really gives us useful tools to be more financially literate. And part of the issue is that, you know, they've done studies that show that sort of financial literacy lessons like that are very distinctly like you should do this, like a Susie Orman, you should put 10% of this check into this. Like, those things fade. Like, you get that lesson and it disappears from your memory eventually. And again, our hope with the book is that it's more like if you, instead of getting the this is what you should do, we present this is why you're doing what you're doing. These are the forces at play. Then hopefully that will create within yourself an ability to develop your own system. Because what limited financial literacy there is, and as you're correct to point out, there isn't much of it, it doesn't really stick with people because it's sort of presented almost like a fact. Like, who remembers the capital of South Dakota? I think it's Boise, right? No, it's Idaho. See, even I don't know. And I'm sitting here, I got a computer, I can look it up. The point is, people don't remember those sort of hard fact rules. But if you give them other tools that sort of help you become emotionally connected to the things that we do, the decisions that we make, you're more likely to help them make better decisions in the future. But that's not how we teach when we do teach finance. That's not what we do.
So let's dig in concretely into some of these kind of biases, as we call them, biases, value cues, and shortcuts. I want to talk about a couple specific ones. So
sure.
To start out, you know, in the work that you did with Dan, what were some of the most obvious traps that people fall into or biases that people fall prey to?
The one that I've often used to sort of introduce what the book is about, and that's pretty obvious, is this concept of relativity, which is that we often measure something based upon comparing it to something else. And the easy example why this doesn't work, and it, you know, this is the holiday season, is sales. You go and you go to a store and you're more likely to buy a sweater that used to be $100, but it's marked down to $60 than you are to buy a sweater that's just listed at $60. And it's because you think there's more value because you're, quote unquote, saving $40. Right. It used to be $100, and I compare it to $100, $60 is a great deal. Whereas just $60 on its own, there's nothing to compare it to, so you don't know how to evaluate that. And it is a simple trap, and it's a simple solution. You shouldn't ever think about what you're, quote unquote, not spending. You should think about what you are spending and decide, is that worth it? Now, maybe it's worth it to buy a $60 sweater. So be it. Go for it. And maybe you would have paid $100. So in a way, like, you do feel like you're getting value, but don't just look at that number that at what it used to be. And that is something that, you know, retailers and so many commercial interests do, is they put a price out there, and then that price sort of is slashed because that helps us compare the two. One sort of real world example I like to give people, you know, what's an easier question to answer? What do you want for dinner tonight? Or would you like chicken or fish for dinner? In the first, it's a whole world of possibility. In the second, you have something to compare it to. Do I like chicken or fish better? That's an easy choice, or it's an easy process to decide yes or no. Whereas if it's wide open, you can't. The same as if you're looking at a sweater and it's $60 and you're trying to decide, is this worth it? Like, I don't know if it's worth it to spend this money, if I value it that highly or not. That's more difficult than, would you like a $60 sweater or a $100 sweater? Of course I'd like a $60 sweater. Right? That's what that choice becomes. It doesn't become, do you want a $60 sweater, or do you want to spend money on a sweater? It becomes, do you want $60 or $100? And that's really sort of the obvious trap, excuse me, that I think we all fall into frequently, is getting sort of suckered by sales, by stuff being marked off. Another one that really has stuck with me, and I think I'm seeing it more and more, is something called the pain of paying. And that is the concept and the idea that when we pay for something, it stimulates the same region of our brain as when we feel pain, physical pain. And that's important. Feeling pain has an evolutionary purpose. You know, you put your hand on a stove and that burn teaches you not to touch the stove anymore. And so we should learn from pain. But often what happens in the financial world is, instead of like feeling that pain and being conscious of what we're doing and learning not to do it, we just numb the pain. We stop feeling it. And financially, the way that the pain hits us is twofold. One is just being aware of the spending. You know, when you pull a $20 bill out of your wallet and you hand it over to someone, you're very aware that you're spending that $20. When you use Apple Pay and just swipe at something really briefly, you're much less aware how much you're spending. And, you know, there are studies showing when people use credit cards as the classic example of less awareness of paying, they spend more, they tip more, and they're more likely to forget how much they spend. You know, I ask people all the time, do you use credit card? Yes. How many people know at the end of the month exactly what their credit card bill will be? Almost nobody knows that, right? We forget how much we spend, and it just sort of adds up. And an amazing thing to me, a study that I found that just sort of floored me, was that effect, what they call the credit card premium, it takes place even when you don't actually use a credit card. If you just put out paraphernalia for a credit card, like a credit card swipe machine, a little MasterCard sticker, just putting that at the place of payment makes people spend more, tip more, and more likely to forget how much they're spending. It's less than using the credit card, but it still impacts. I mean, we've become so in tune with that shortcut, with that value cue, with that bias, that it's just a trigger to us. It's Pavlovian. And, you know, not being aware of that pain of paying, not feeling that pain, makes us do things that maybe we wouldn't if we just stopped to think, is it worth it? Many of your listeners, I imagine, are at a point in their lives when they're probably starting to save, like 401ks, right? They're starting to save for retirement. They're starting to invest more. And, you know, you think about like funds where you invested like an index fund and there's a management fee. And for ease of numbers, let's say that the management fee of 1% and you've got a $1 million portfolio, in which case you should buy both of my books, not just one. But say you got a $1 million portfolio and there's 1% management fee. What happens is that 1%, you never see that 1% leave, right? You just get your statements at the end of the year, and somewhere there's a line that says that they took their 1% off of everything. But what if instead of it just being buried in a statement, at the end of every year, you had to write your broker a check for $10,000. You'd feel that pain, and you would at least stop and say, oh, is it worth it to pay $10,000 for what this broker is doing or not? But we don't feel that pain, And therefore, you know, because we're not aware of it, and therefore we don't have that hand on the stove burning moment of saying, oh, should I change or not? And that's this pain of paying, or really the way that our culture has evolved to numb that pain of paying, is a huge, huge thing that we fall into. And it's something that concerns me as I look at the way technology is really advanced. I mentioned Apple Pay. So many of like these fintech developments are to quote unquote make paying easier. Yeah, it's easier, but it makes paying easier. It doesn't mean it makes, you know, your choices better. It just makes it easier for that money to flow out of your pocket. And that isn't necessarily a good thing. Again, we don't want people to become freaks and think about every spending decision. And if you've decided to have your coffee every day for $5, great, just spend it. But when you're not aware of decisions at all, when it just sort of flows out, when you've got, you know, Amazon technology everywhere with one-click spending and you never think about what you're doing, that's not financially healthy. And I think what ends up happening is it's almost like we have an obesity crisis in finance, but no one's aware that they're obese. We have a spending crisis, but no one's really aware that they're doing it because we don't feel that pain of paying. The relativity and the pain of paying are sort of two of the early ones we talk about in the book. There's tons of them, but those are two that I always feel like everybody deals with that and gets what we're saying when we explain it.
I think those are both great examples. And the relativity bias makes me think of a joke my father-in-law always says, which is when his wife comes home from shopping, he goes, how much did I save today? Right. And says, you know, so it's like, how much was everything on sale? But I'm curious, is there kind of a component of anchoring bias kind of embedded within that bias?
Absolutely. Everything isn't totally clean that it's just one force impacting another, but anchoring is very much at play when it comes to like sales. And anchoring is the idea that you see the first figure that you see about a product will sort of determine what you think it's worth, especially when it's something you can't assess. One example is when they came out with the iPhone, right? Steve Jobs said, you know, this iPhone is on sale for $600, right? Now, when you come out with the iPhone, like how did you evaluate what an iPhone is worth? You've had cell phones, but all of a sudden you can do all these other things, have this functionality. You can, you know, you can look at pictures, you can go online, you can do amazing things, but how do you evaluate that? What's that worth? So we said $600. Then a few weeks later, the price was lowered to $400. Suddenly, oh my gosh, that's a great deal. Then the factors at play are both that relativity, like it seems like a relative great deal, and the fact that we had heard $600. So we think, oh, that's the number associated with it. And we are drawn to, I mean, it's called anchoring because it's like an anchor that you just can't get too far from it. And when I was looking at the research here, one of the amazing things about anchoring is not just how often it comes into play, but that it is so powerful that the numbers don't even have to necessarily relate to the product you're buying. There's a thing called arbitrary coherence. And arbitrary is the key word here, that they did an experiment where they'd have people write down the last two digits of their social security number, right? Completely random, like what the numbers could be. And then they would have them bid on items that they really couldn't assess the true value, like obscure wines or random chocolates or new technology things, stuff that you didn't know what it was worth at all. And they found that those people that had written down high two numbers, like their social security ended in 89 or 94, they would bid higher on all the other products that were random than those that had low social security numbers, like 24 or 12. And it was just because they had these high numbers primed into their head. Now, by all rights, the social security number has nothing to do with the price of a bottle of wine. But because we are creatures that seek consistency, that seek to make logic, that look for value cues, we will grasp on to whatever number, whatever anchor we can find in order to give ourselves some stability. And, you know, it's something that, you know, you should be aware of as consumers. You know, you walk by a store and, you know, they have a $1,000 item, you know, a pair of sneakers for $1,000 in the window. No one's going to buy $1,000 sneakers, right? But you go inside and suddenly there's a $250 sneaker, and subconsciously you have that $1,000 crazy thing in the window that sort of anchored you to, this is a place to buy expensive sneakers, and $250 doesn't seem so bad. So anchoring is something that works with relativity, that is everywhere. You know, go to buy a car and there's a car on the, you know, on the showroom floor that's all souped up, that's, you know, $75,000. Suddenly spending $35,000, $40,000 doesn't seem like that big a deal.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hiring the right person takes time. Time that you often don't have. But you shouldn't let a time crunch get in the way of finding the right candidates for your business. That's why LinkedIn is the best place to post your job. In fact, I was on LinkedIn Jobs this morning looking for candidates to fill a key role in one of my businesses. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with hard and soft skills you're looking for so that you can hire the right person quickly. You can look for things like collaboration, creativity, and adaptability, looking beyond just work skills and resumes to connect you with the candidates who are a perfect match for your business. That's how LinkedIn makes sure that your job post gets in front of the people you actually want to hire, because they have a much better ability to get a deep insight into exactly who is the right candidate for you and your business. Find the right person meant for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want, and the first $50 is on them. Just visit linkedin.com/success. Again, that's linkedin.com/success to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
So, you know, one of the other examples that when you're talking about fees and the pain of paying, and if you look at your brokerage statement, you know, one of the mental models that I think is one of the most powerful around kind of, finance, money, personal finance, et cetera, is the power of compounding and how incredibly impactful compound interest can be over time. But one of the most interesting kind of ways to look at fees specifically is to think about the compounded value of fees, especially percentage fees over time, right? So that 1% mm-hmm. that you don't see gets compounded essentially out of what you're doing over time. And if you run the numbers, you know, even small differences in a management fee can make a huge, huge difference over like a 20-year time horizon and what the compounded kind of end result is.
Yeah. I mean, that's one way that you might better think about looking at a fee is like it's like a negative compound interest. I'm not sure if that's quite the right term, but yeah, you lose that $10,000 and it's not just, oh, is it worth $10,000? But the question is it worth $10,000 this year, next year is actually $11,000, which the following year is 12,100. I can't do compound interest off the top of my head, but yeah, is that value worth it? I mean, it's staggering, and there are people that have developed charts to show what you lose. And you know, that's not to say the choice is okay, have something with no management fees or the lowest management fees, because that isn't always the best choice. It's just be aware. And what often happens is that we obsess over these sorts of details for small financial decisions, but not large ones, right? So we go to a supermarket and we can't decide if we should get the organic tomatoes that are 35 cents more than the regular tomatoes. And we sit there and we weigh and we think about whether or not organic is really good for us and, you know, what is our health concern and all this stuff. But then we go and we buy a house or we remodel a home for $200,000 and someone comes and says, hey, you know, for an extra $5,000, you can have something Italian, right? You can have some marble thing. And you're like, okay, whatever, it's just $5,000. So who cares? Right, all the tomato saving in the world is not going to add up to that $5,000, but oftentimes it's the little ones we obsess about, not the big ones. And we would suggest that you obsess about the big decisions and let the little ones go, that we sort of reverse that mindset. I remember my own personal life example is I went on a family vacation. I can't remember. It was a long time ago, but we went to Capri, the Isle of Capri, right? Which is a super expensive island. And I'm sure it was a really expensive vacation. It was a special trip. I don't know exactly what it cost because I was along for the ride as a little kid back when this happened. But, you know, let's say the trip costs $15,000. Let's say that's the figure. And I can remember my parents arguing with a cab driver over like $2 of a tip, you know, spending like 20 minutes arguing about this. And, you know, I didn't think about it at the time, but in retrospect, it's like, we just sort of wrote off, hey, let's spend 10 grand, but we're going to waste our time arguing over $2. You know, I think there are deeper psychological reasons, and I don't want to get too much on the couch here and talk about my mother and my feelings towards my family. But from a perspective of rationality and money and what's the sort of scientifically backed approach, that wasn't the wisest choice of which battle to pick.
So for someone listening, how can they pick the kind of bigger battles when they're facing that decision?
I think it's up to them to decide what are the less frequent, the special spending times. And by special, I mean, you can sort of just categorize it as large, you know, buying a house, buying a car, starting a new job, and signing up for your benefits and your 401k withdrawals. Like, think about those things that really have a significant amount of money involved with it, because those are the ones, it's almost like the compound interest deal. Like, those are the ones where the little decisions will mean a lot. And don't worry about that other stuff. Now, that's not to say you should never think, should I spend, you know, $5 on a latte? You know, our advice would be, there's spending that is infrequent and small. Like, you go to buy a pack of gum once in a while. Don't worry. Don't stress about that. Then there's spending that is relatively small, but is frequent. That's a habit, right? Like, you decide to spend $5 on a coffee, or you just decide every Friday night, I'm going out to my favorite restaurant and bar and I'm spending $150. Don't think about that every time, but once in a while, once every year, once every 6 months, look back at all that spending and decide whether or not it's worth it and how you might adjust that habit. And then it becomes a habit again, but do consider it once in a while. Then there's the big spending things. And for those, because they do have so much of an impact, because like the result of that choice can impact your ability to do all those other smaller choices and have the money to have a $100 dinner every week, it's worth taking some time and thinking about what are the real forces at play here, and what, you know, really matters to me. And ultimately, what are the opportunity costs? You know, as your listeners move forward in their lives and sort of get to a point where I am, like, I have two young kids and we have a nice house, but it's a small house. And it's like, oh, we could spend more to get a bigger house. But does that mean that we can't take some cool, real experience vacations that might enhance our lives more than just having more room? And it's a difficult choice, but it's something to think about and to sort of weigh. And oftentimes with that example, people are just like, oh, I got to get the bigger house. They don't think about what they're giving up. And, you know, our advice would be, at those moments, that's when you do think about it. Don't worry about what you're giving up when you're buying $1.50 piece of gum, but, you know, do when it's $150,000 more of a house or so.
And I've found, you know, I think this also kind of comes out of being in the financial world, but it's definitely not a perfect model, but the kind of yardstick that I typically use to think about the opportunity cost of, you know, spending, and then again, more for big picture spending items like you're talking about, but is to think about sort of, I just use one alternative, and that's basically, if I were to invest this, you know, at a, let's say between sort of a 6% and 8% compounded annual return for 20 years, like, what's the better use of these funds? Is it to spend it on this, or is it to just to invest it? And that's definitely not a perfect proxy, but it's a, you know, kind of a good enough proxy in many ways to just think about, okay, what's a better use of this capital? Is it to spend it on, you know, a new sofa and renovating the kitchen, or is it to spend it on investing this money so that I can have, you know, savings and kind of build some wealth over time?
Right. And it's great that you're able to think about that, because that's a difficult way. It's challenging for us to think about the future like that. We have a chapter in the book all about self-control, and that itself could be a whole book. And the real challenge of self-control, particularly when it comes to like savings and investing for retirement, and while we have such a retirement crisis, is that people have a hard time thinking about their future selves. That even though it's me when I'm 65, 75, I'm not connected to that emotionally as much as I am to me right now. So to think about my needs later, it's really hard to connect and to feel obliged. You know, we always think of ourselves as being better in the future. Like, I might not save now, but in a couple of years I'll start saving, right? You keep making those promises to yourself. Or, you know, you think everything will be fine, you know, I'll be fine by the time I'm 70. You don't think about all the things you need. And part of that is because we're not emotionally connected. And when it comes to saving, it's also because it's so hard to figure out. You know, in retirement, you have to figure out, how long are you going to work? How much money will you have saved? How long are you going to live after you stop working? What's your cost of living going to be? What are your health issues going to be? What are your kids going to be doing? All these things that are just totally unpredictable. And so in some ways, it's easier to not think about all that hard stuff. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of what we humans want to do is we want to go the path of least resistance. We want the easy
solution, the quick solution. And that's understandable. That's human nature. And we don't suggest you try to change human nature. You just are aware of it. And every now and then you choose the hard path. And also every now and then you create systems to let the easy path happen. Like, you know, places that have, speaking of retirement, that have made it so that you start a job and the default option is that you are putting aside money for retirement, as opposed to you have to select that. You know, you have to opt out instead of opting in because you're automatically in. The savings rate is skyrocket. I mean, it's tremendously different just because the easy way is just to let the default ride. And when that default is savings, people do it more. And you can apply that to so many things. I mentioned having two different accounts. Like, you can go one time to your HR department and say, you know what, put $200 of every check of mine into this separate account. Then you put it in that account and it's there and you never have to think about it again. And you can sort of set up default systems so that you don't have to think about it every time. And that's, you know, what we would advise you to try to do as much as possible when you recognize your own financial failings.
So let's dig a little bit deeper into self-control, since we kind of started talking about that. What were some of the lessons that you saw from the work that you did around the book?
That self-control is really hard. That, you know, we looked at different situations, and it ultimately is about emotion. And I'll take a little mini detour to say that, you know, when it comes to the world of finance, and when it particularly, let's be honest, comes to men thinking about the world of finance, we don't think emotion plays in. We think it's just a number game, a numbers game. But really, emotion does play in. And the emotions are things like being connected to the desire of now, to falling for the temptation of now, to falling for, like, I want this motorcycle, I want this sound system, I want these things that I can feel now, as opposed to that stuff that's way in the distant future that you're not emotionally connected to. You know, I mean, an easy sort of study or example is studies that show that in a state of arousal, people will do totally irrational, unethical, immoral things because they are emotionally compromised. So, you know, one sort of lesson, one sort of practical piece of advice is to try to, like, insulate ourselves from those challenging emotions, to insulate ourselves from the difficulty of self-control. There are things that we call Ulysses contract. They're called Ulysses contract because, you know, in the story of Ulysses, he wanted to hear the sound of the sirens, but he knew that you go by the sirens and all these ships crash against the rock because they were so tempting. So he had himself tied to the mast and he had his crew put stuff in their ears so they couldn't hear the sirens. And he told them, no matter what I say, don't let me, you know, tell you to go sail closer to the sound. And that worked, right? They got past the sirens. He heard the songs and it was great. And now they're on Spotify, but he didn't crash. And so you can set up systems for yourself to do the same thing, that sort of make it so that you can't take it out, that you can't, like, misspend your money, that you can't fall victim to your failings of self-control. In some ways, you know, that tax penalty that comes when you set up an IRA and you are penalized, I think it's like 10,000 or maybe it's a percentage, I'm not sure, but you're penalized if you take early withdrawal. That's in essence, you know, a Ulysses contract. You're getting punished for not sticking with the promise you've made to yourself. So being aware of that, being aware that you may have to sort of lock yourself into the good behavior, can be a way to overcome self-control. You know, there are other tricks, something we call reward substitution, which is, if you're having trouble doing something because it doesn't feel good, that you find, you know, an alternative, a way to reward yourself in a way that does feel good. You know, obviously you don't want to, like, undermine the benefits. Like, if you're having trouble exercising, don't reward yourself with a milkshake. Like, that's silly. But if you're having trouble exercising, reward yourself, you know, with an hour of Netflix, or reward yourself with something else that provides you pleasure, so that pushing through that difficult thing that you don't want to do becomes about achieving a goal that you want, not about achieving whatever the goal is of exercise, of losing weight, of better health and all that, if you don't connect to it.
So in many ways, you know, that makes me think of essentially kind of using decision architecture to create self-control for yourself, you know, kind of similar to, if you're thinking about weight loss or something like that, taking all the snacks out of your house so that there's nothing to snack on, or, you know, putting your gym clothes next to the bed kind of ready to go so that you make it easier for yourself to go to the gym the next morning.
It's exactly that. It's recognizing and being comfortable admitting that we have human failings, that we're not like perfect machines, and saying, okay, I'm not a perfect dude that's just going to get up and work out and never eat candy. I have to make it hard for myself. There are studies regarding, like, people trying to have better diabetic outcome that literally show putting a bowl of healthy snacks
celery, carrots, grapes, whatever it is, putting the bowl of healthy snacks in the front of the fridge or on the counter has tremendous impact versus like having it be like that candy. You know, you walk through a lot of offices, they have administrative cubicles in the middle and people like have little candy and it's great. You go and you grab some candy and you chat with that person. And it's a great relationship, but because it's so easy, you just grab it. And if you do hide the bad snacks, I'm not saying don't ever have a snack. You'll be a miserable person if you never eat a piece of chocolate, but if you hide them, you're less likely to eat them. And that's admitting that it's a challenge. And I don't have the data on this. I haven't seen it, but I know that guys, especially guys that consider themselves high achievers, they don't want to admit their failings. But that is actually the best thing you can do. And in some ways, it's a strength. It's a sign of a really strong person is recognizing those areas that you're not awesome at and seeking to improve them. And that's what we can do when we see what our failings are. Whether it's we eat too much snacks or we don't save enough money or we buy too many $1,000 shoes.
I mean, that is probably the single most recurrent theme on the podcast. The idea that self-awareness is really the cornerstone of improvement, making better decisions and kind of understanding what needs to be done to get where you want to get. And whether it's saving money, whether it's, you know, your own personal health, whether it's achieving your goals, you have to start with a really honest assessment of kind of who you are, where your skills are today. And once you are capable of doing that, you can really move past any kind of obstacles. But if you get trapped, kind of caught in the trap of self-sabotage, it becomes really, really hard to, and sort of lack of self-awareness, it becomes really hard to ever move beyond the same thing that keeps stopping you over and over again.
Absolutely. And I will say I've been speaking more to groups that are sort of involved in the investment community, like fund managers and people in New York and London who are super high achieving alpha dog guys, largely men who, you know, top of the finance game, a world where you think is very just knee-jerk reaction opposed to things that sound sort of what I call woo-woo, you know, sort of soft science like self-awareness and mindset. And I have been really pleasantly surprised by how receptive they've become. You know, I don't have the data to say they weren't receptive 15 years ago, but I feel like that they probably weren't. I mean, I know that's not hard science, but regardless, I've been happy to see how they have embraced that. Even these highest achievers in a field that you think are very like closed off to emotions playing a role, they're very open to it. And I tell people, you know, like if these super alpha dogs get it, you know, the rest of us can certainly get it. You see it in sports too. You know, like Tom Brady is an alpha dog, but he's very like, it's about your mind body set. It's about your health, your mental health, your physical health, and having all those pieces together. And, you know, I'm really pleased that that's extending to sort of all different practices and all different fields.
So one other bias that you wrote about that I want to touch on is fairness and effort. Tell me a little bit mm-hmm. about how we sometimes kind of think erroneously about that.
Sure. Often, as I said before, what happens is it's hard to assess the value of something in the financial realm and other realms is what's it worth to pay. And so we go for these shortcuts. And one shortcut that we take is we assess the effort it took to produce something. Like people are more willing to pay for a locksmith that fumbles around and breaks some stuff and has to run back to his truck 10 times. It takes an hour to open your door than a locksmith who comes and opens it in a minute, right? Because it looks like it was a lot more effort, that it was a lot more fair to pay for all that work. When really what should matter is what's the value to you of getting into your house? It shouldn't matter how long it takes. In fact, that first the second person who spends just 1 minute is more valuable, right? Because on the other hand, that other locksmith, you're paying for his incompetence. But we don't know how to assess value. What's the value of getting into your home, right? Like, what is that worth financially? Unless you're working hourly and, you know, the tab is running or the meter is running in your house, there's no way to know what that's worth. So we fall for effort. And it's something that happens to us outside of the locksmith realm. People will pay more for data recovery if, you know, a technician takes a week to fix and save your computer data than if they take an hour. Consultants, you know, large firms hire like a McKinsey or an outside consultant. They show up with a 600-slide PowerPoint presentation explaining everything they've done and, you know, what the food was served on the flight out to Columbus that week to study with you. And, you know, all you care about is the final slide and the final, you know, recommendation. But they have this long thing because it shows how hard they worked. And then they throw you a check for $250,000 for your company and you sign off on it because, you know, it's hard to assess the value of what they've done. So you look at the effort and whether or not it's fair. And, you know, this is it's a real challenge because, you know, people can take advantage of that. Like you might say a McKinsey sort of takes advantage of the fact that we don't know how to assess their value. And, you know, there are times when that's good and times when that's a challenge. Like, you know, there is a story, I think it's just a fable, but it's illustrative that a woman saw Pablo Picasso in a park and walked up to Pablo Picasso and said, "Will you paint my portrait?" And he said, "Sure." And he looked at her for a minute. Then with a single brushstroke, he painted a perfect image of her and gave it to her and said, "Oh my God, this is beautiful. You captured everything about me. How, I don't know how you possibly did this. How much do I owe you?" And he said, $5,000. And she said, "What? That's totally unfair. It took you no effort. It only took you a minute." And he said, "No, it took me a lifetime plus a minute." And so she, judging just on that effort, couldn't assess the value of his whole lifetime of knowledge. It's sort of, you know, those knowledge economy, the people that are, you know, professional writers, but they only take an hour to do something. If you just pay him for that hour, you're not really paying them what the value is. So we oftentimes will underestimate value. At the same time, we'll overestimate because we see the effort. Restaurants are great at playing into this. Like you get a menu item at a fancy restaurant and it describes like everything about the food, like where the spinach was grown, like the meat, like what the name of the cow was and how often it was petted by like Aboriginal kids and you know, all these things and how far it traveled across the land and how many people were lost at sea bringing this piece of meat to you. And it's really just a cheeseburger and you'll pay $35 for it because it seems like it was worth the effort. So a reliance on what we can see is a challenge. And it's been interesting to me to see how companies have become more aware of that, not just to sort of be that manipulative person, but also to proactively. I mean, you know, the city of Boston had a real problem because there are tons of potholes in the winters, right? Let's say there are, you know, 10,000 potholes around the city of Boston. If you live in Boston, you open your door, you see three potholes on your street, you call the city, and you never see them fix it, you're going to think they're doing nothing. So the city of Boston, they created a website that showed the 10,000 potholes and also showed which ones they fixed that day. So if you went there and saw, oh, they fixed 25 potholes today, it wasn't one on my street, but they're clearly working, suddenly you see their effort. And suddenly you like appreciate the value of, you know, if you took it enough steps, like your tax dollars and your government and all that. The point is they're showing the effort. And oftentimes companies that are being undervalued or people that are being undervalued could show their effort more. You know, the trick is, of course, when to know as a consumer, are they showing real effort that we should value, or are they showing effort in a fake attempt to like inflate their worth?
You know, I love that Picasso story, and I it's funny. I was actually going to give that example, but you beat me to it. It's one of my favorite stories, and I commonly share that with people. I'm curious, you know, we talked a little bit about this, and as we're kind of wrapping up, what are some kind of practical pieces of advice or maybe a piece of homework to give to somebody listening to this that they could start with as kind of a beginning step towards understanding their own biases and how that impacts their thinking specifically within the realm of kind of money?
Well, there are a ton of things you can do. And, you know, before giving a piece of advice that applies to everyone, you know, the suggestion would be to look at sort of which bias or which value cue really resonates as something you do and then sort of address that. But one common thing you can do is if you are, you know, the pain of paying I mentioned is something that's very common and that a lot of people sort of suffer with is start paying in cash a little bit more. You know, it's a challenge in our economy to try to be all cash. Many places don't even take it anymore, but start paying in cash a little more frequently and see if you make different choices. Similarly, you could, you know, look at your monthly credit card bill or even get a spending buddy. And I don't suggest you use a spouse if any of our listeners are married, but get a spending buddy and go through your monthly credit card and just explain every item on there and, you know, justify it, say what it was. And then you'll find just having gone through that process, when you start spending again and you have your next credit card bill, you could either do it again with a spending buddy or just be aware of that. You'll be more conscious of sort of what each item is that you spend. Talked about the idea of like having a different account for discretionary spending. You can do that. If you have the ability, you can try using prepaid debit cards for, you know, weekly spending. If you really are spending too much money on a week-to-week basis, like you go out and you spend a lot, give yourself a prepaid debit card of however much money you think you can spend each week and give it to yourself on Monday. Don't give it on Friday because Friday you'll go out on the weekend and spend it all. Give it to yourself on Monday. And that's all you can spend. I mean, stuff like this is pretty restrictive, and I wouldn't suggest going through your life like this, but you do it two or three or five times and you start to recognize your own sort of patterns and you start to get into better habits. And then, you know, you can go back to stuff that's maybe a little less cumbersome. To whatever extent possible, don't have things on auto pay. You know, don't just use the latest technology because it's easier to pay. Like Amazon developed a store recently where you just walk in. You never go to a checkout counter. You walk in, you put stuff in your bag, and a little chip reader scanner somehow connects to your credit card and pays. So you walk in, you walk out. And that's so much easier, quote unquote, to shop. But that's not good for your spending. So don't leap to the first new technology thinking it's great without thinking about what it really does. Ultimately, the thing is just to sort of stop and think. Every now and then, you know, I mentioned the different type of spending, the small spending, the habitual sort of habit spending, and the big spending. And every now and then, just stop and think about those habits, stop and think about the big spending, and just take a beat and think about opportunity costs. Think about what else you could do. And you'll find that that adjusts your mind and adjusts your mindset and adjusts the way that you value money in the future.
And Jeff, where can listeners find you and your books online?
Jeff Kreisler, KreisLer.com. My Twitter is Jeff Kreisler. I also have a behavioral science Twitter, Jeff Kreisler BS. And yes, there's a double entendre there. And starting in 2018, I'll be the editor of a new website called PeopleScience.com, which is all about applied behavioral science. You know, but certainly just going to Jeff Kreisler and following down that rabbit hole. Plus, I speak for groups all over the nation, colleges and companies. So I'm often near you wherever you are. Books coming out around the world. So I'm hoping to get abroad in 2018. But Jeff Kreisler is a good start. And yeah, that's it.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing all of the wisdom that you have about personal finance, biases, and how we often misthink money.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great podcast, and I hope you have the greatest success.
Thank you so much for listening to The Science of Success. We created this show to help you, our listeners, master evidence-based growth. I love hearing from listeners. If you want to reach out, share your story, or just say hi, shoot me an email. My email is matt@successpodcast.com. That's M-A-T-T at successpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I read and respond to every single listener email. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should sign up for our email list today by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage. There's some incredible stuff that's only available to those on the email list, so be sure to sign up, including an exclusive curated weekly email from us called Mindset Monday, which is short, simple, filled with articles, stories, things that we found interesting and fascinating in the world of evidence-based growth in the last week. Next, you're getting an exclusive chance to shape the show, including voting on guests, submitting your own personal questions that we'll ask guests on air, and much more. Lastly, you're going to get a free guide we created based on listener demand, our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide, by signing up and joining the email list today. Again, you can do that at successpodcast.com, sign up right at the homepage, or if you're on the go, just text the word SMARTER, S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. Remember, the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to a friend, either live or online. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us an awesome review and subscribe on iTunes, because that helps boost the algorithm, that helps us move up the iTunes rankings, and helps more people discover the science of success. Don't forget, if you want to get all the incredible information we talk about in the show, links, transcripts, everything we discuss, and much more, be sure to check out our show notes. You can get those at successpodcast.com. Just hit the show notes button right at the top. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Science of Success.